The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad you could join me today. It's January 18th, 2014, and I have what I think will be an interesting, informative program. We are inching up on the 27th. On Monday, I am going to have Guillermo Rudolph and, if he can make it, Bradley Smith, on the Heretics Hour with me to talk more about that. Today, I could not get Vincent Renoir to show up. They have a very busy schedule, and I certainly understand that. So I'm going it alone, but I'm never at a loss for what to say, it seems. In fact, I often find something in the news the very morning of the program that is relevant to the subjects I prepared, and that is the case today. I'm going to start out with something that I discovered this morning that I thought was very interesting. And that's just another one of these articles that shows us how those who want to support Israel and support the Jews and be against anti-Semitism and so on to such a great extent always refer back to the Holocaust for the reasons that this is so important to do. And today there is a story about Jason Kenney, who is someone who is saying that he is part of the Stephen Harper government in Canada, and he is saying that Canada has a moral obligation to support a secure homeland in Israel for the Jewish people. And I ask the question, you know, right away, why would Canada have a moral obligation to support Israel and the Jewish people? Well, of course, when he gives his answer, it finally comes down to the bottom line that, let's see, because I've got a bit of other stuff here, that Israel is a refuge for the Jewish people born out of the ashes of the Holocaust. Okay? So before I go further into what he said, I looked him up, and I'm glad I did, because I found out some things about him. Jason Kenney. He's currently 45 years old. He is Canada's Minister of Employment and Social Development and Minister for Multiculturalism. That's his title. And he's in the Stephen Harper conservative government. I believe it's there that call themselves the Tories over there, something like that. and in 2008, he was these things, but his title has now changed. In 2008, he became Minister for Citizenship, Immigration, and Multiculturalism. So, you know, he's not Minister for Employment, but he's Minister for Citizenship, Immigration, and Multiculturalism. And I mean, totally promoting a multicultural Canada, while at the same time, he and that whole government promotes a homeland for the Jews in Israel, a Jewish state, only a Jewish state in Israel, and wants to help them protect their their racial state. Now, Jason Kenney is a Roman Catholic, and if he's Jewish, he's crypto-Jewish, as sometimes Catholics can be. He is one of the world changers. You know, that's his whole philosophy, what I'd call him. And he is single. He's a politician that has never been married. I find that kind of odd, you know. He was first elected to the House of Commons at the age of 29. He's been very ambitious about politics from an early age. So he's now, as I said, he's now 45 and he's never been married. He graduated from a private Catholic high school for boys, I assume for boys, and then attended the University of San Francisco from his home in Canada. He grew up in Saskatchewan, which is a Jesuit university in San Francisco, California. Does that ring any bells to anybody, you know? So he went to this Jesuit university in San Francisco. And then his wiki page, which I looked over pretty carefully, shows no social affiliation with any woman. I mean, he's not been attached to any woman. He's not been seen, you know, not talking about any friendships that he's had over the years or anything like that. So it's safe to say, I think, that he's not sexually attracted to women. But he's hardworking, ambitious, and works to implement his agenda. In fact, even after I decided that myself about him, I read further down on the page that he's famous for his 20-hour workdays. He's like a workaholic who's always working for the good of the Canadian people and to, you know, improve things. One of his priorities was listed as a poll that showed over, must have been his poll, over 80% of Canadians support stripping citizenship from Canadian terrorists. We know who the terrorists are in Canada, right? And it's clear from today's news from him what he thinks, you know, who he would consider to be the terrorists. And they're never Jews. That's one thing. But you and I would be considered terrorists if we were in Canada. And if I had my websites and so on in Canada, I suppose I would not be able to do that. It's just right across the border, friends, and we're the last man standing as far as freedom of speech goes in this world. So going to this article today, as I already said, that he's on his way to Israel, and he gave an interview with somebody, and he said a lot of terrible things in this interview, and he and Harper and some other people from Canada's, from Harper's government, are going on this trip to Israel in a few days or so. And guess who's also going? Also is going people, some Canadian Jewish people are also going on that trip with Harper and Kenny and a few other, you know, government ministers. And so he says in the interview, Kenny says, the real reason that we have taken these positions, these hard-line positions in favor of Israel and for always being, you know, always supporting and being a friend to Israel no matter what, is because we see what is, in our view, plainly evident. Now, see, that doesn't answer anything, but it shows that what they... They're trying to tell you that their reasons are so plain to see, plain for anybody to see. And what is it? It's what I already said. It's that Israel is a refuge for the Jewish people born out of the ashes of the Holocaust. And also he made the comment that Israel faces a daily existential struggle for its survival. Well, that's pure Jewish public relations, because it's not true. In Israel, they don't face a daily existential struggle for their survival. It's actually the Arabs and the particularly the Palestinians that do, but that's their story. And, of course, one thing we know when we're dealing with Jews is that they take what is the facts and they turn it around. I mean, they are the persecutors in every case, but they turn it around and make the people they're persecuting they're persecutors, and they're the victims. This is what they always do, and this is what people like Jason Kenney, you know, are helping them with. So they say, you know, the only struggle that the Jews in Israel have is to bribe and blackmail enough money from other countries and people to keep their country going. Because if it wasn't for that, they wouldn't be able to keep their country going. Not with all the hardware and the military might and so on that they have just, but in almost every instance, they do not support themselves. So other things that are important here is another full quote from the cabinet minister, from Kenny. And, you know, Kenny must be an Irish name is what I figure. He must have Irish background. It says, a quote from him, he says, "There is some kind of moral obligation on the entire world to support a secure homeland for the Jewish people, given not just the Holocaust, but the entire history of anti-Semitism, both in Europe, the Middle East, and elsewhere." See, now this is pure BS line that's given out by international Jewry. Now, he mentioned Holocaust specifically two or three times. I'm not sure if it was three times. It was these two times I've told you for sure. And, you know, made it the foundation of the reasons why we have to help Israel. And he says, in Canada, the federal government has adopted a zero-tolerance approach to anti-Semitism in Canada ever since the 9/11 terrorist attacks. There's been the emergence of something that many people call the new anti-Semitism. "We see a kind of culture of hatred," he says, "in various parts of the world, regrettably in some dark corners of Canada, as some of this kind of new anti-Semitism." And he said that this hatred he sees repeats many of the old canards and conspiracy theories of the old European style anti-Semitism. So why read that is that now he's attacking his own European people, his own European white people as being guilty of repeating all these old canards and conspiracy theories, which they are not. They're the truth, but he calls this a new virulent form of violence. I don't know. That's not a quote. I don't know where that came from. But then here's another quote from him. "It often finds itself," speaking about this new anti-Semitism, "it often finds itself at the nexus between radical jihadi Islamism and the far left." Now they're going after the left, you know, because the left is becoming very intolerant of Israel's what they see as racist and fascistic and nationalistic positions and their violence against people. So the left is taking out after Israel, not Jews, but Israel. And this now has to be combated by the friends of Israel. And so they're leaving today, I guess today or else next Saturday, for a week-long trip to the Middle East, this group from the Canadian government, and members of the Canadian Jewish community will come along. I already said that. Not much else, same old stuff, you know. They're looking for negotiating a two-state settlement. That's what they're after, which, of course, the Palestinians will get the worst of it, and they'll eventually be wiped out by the larger state of Israel. But that's what they're trying to accomplish there. And then he says, "At the end of the day, we will not accept the notion of a moral equivalence between the hateful terrorism of Israel's worst enemies and counterterrorism designed to defend itself." So they're presenting Israel as carrying out counterterrorism to defend itself from the hateful terrorism of its enemies. Pretty terrible. And of course, Israel's Canada's ambassador from Israel says how much they appreciate Canada's support of Israel as a Jewish state. Amazing. Canada supports Israel as a Jewish state, but is doing everything in its power, this government is, and most Canadians, you know, support it, that that Canada will not be, cannot be, will never be again a British state or an Anglo state. Not even, not anything close to that. It's going to be full of Jews and other alien people. It already is, and it's going to be more so. It's going to be a multicultural state. They even have a minister for multiculturalism. That's this Kenny. So that got me warmed up today, and I had this article from that was published on January 16th, 2 days ago, in the Telegraph, United Kingdom, as a blog. You know, they have these bloggers there, and I guess they can say what they want, and the Telegraph doesn't necessarily take a responsibility for it, but they publish it. Anyway, this one is by someone named Brendan O'Neill, a young guy. He has his picture there, and he looks like, you know, could be in his late 20s or early 30s, and in this picture anyway, but you know, youngish looking 30s. And again, there's a Irish name, seems to me. He is writing what I like it, but it's ridiculous. I mean, he's the stupidest guy. He's writing about the Holocaust deniers, and his title is "Holocaust Denial is Despicable, but It's Wrong to Ban It." Okay. Well, he's arguing that there should not be any censorship of Holocaust deniers, which would be a good thing. But I want to point out the things he's saying, because, you know, I mean, it's such a riot what people like him believe. I imagine that he is sincere here, and he's written blog articles for the Telegraph before. They have some of his previous ones listed. So it's not, he's never written about the Holocaust before that I could see there. And that's why, because he doesn't know anything about it, you know, but he's giving his opinion here. And he says, if I was drawing up a list of the most morally repugnant people, Holocaust deniers would be right up there, probably at the top, in the top three. He says, these pathetic individuals possess all the worst traits of the modern era. They're anti-intellectual. Think about that when you think about the Holocaust believers. Cynically insulating themselves from truth and proven fact. Proven fact. They're paranoid. That's the second thing about them. Being convinced that a conspiracy of dastardly Jews invented a great crime in order to make money and create Israel. Well, there's a lot of truth in that, actually. And, of course, they're hateful. That's the third thing. They're so hateful, being fueled by the oldest of prejudices, anti-Semitism. Well, right there, you know, I mean, I ask, is anti-Semitism the oldest of prejudices? If we go back in time, and if we believe the history that we're given about the Semites in the Middle East and so on, it was Semite hating Semite. That's what it was. We did not have anything to do with them. We didn't have any prejudices against them. We didn't even know them. You know, we weren't involved in their disputes, in their battles, and their hatreds amongst one another. And so, you know, I have to ask how anti-intellectual this Brendan is. And he goes on saying that they dial up their truth-distorting project as a radical or revisionist take on the events of the 20th century, but it doesn't take much scratching, he says, to discover that behind every expression of doubt that the Holocaust occurred, there lurks someone who simply fears and loathes the Jews. You know? So every person who doubts the Holocaust, he's saying, down deep, fears and loathes the Jews. Now, there is a stupid, paranoid, hateful thing to say, I must say. But he doesn't know it. You know, he's completely oblivious to what's real here. And he says, so should we ban them? They seem ideal candidates for censorship. What they say and publish has absolutely no historical or moral worth. I hope I don't, I'm not going to explain this to you because I hope you all understand why it's so funny. And, you know, he says it is factually incorrect. Everything that revisionists say is factually incorrect and also deeply disturbing. And it is upsetting to those who survived the Holocaust or whose forebears perished in it. I would wager that the vast majority of humankind would not miss the outpourings of these scoundrels if they were to be expunged from public life. But then he says, should we expunge them then? No, never. Well, good for him. Good for him. He says, Holocaust denial might be a highly immoral enterprise, but to ban it would be a grave moral error too. Well, he's saying the usual things here. I won't read everything he says. Then he says, the question of whether Holocaust denial should be banned has been raised once more by recent events in France. The ridiculous comedian, he calls him ridiculous, Dieudonné Mbala Mbala, infamous for making the anti-Semitic Canel salute popular, making it popular, is currently banned from performing in various French cities. Well, I want to comment on this idea that that this anti-Semitic Canel, is that the, what, did I forget how to pronounce that? That Canel salute, that's the way I'm doing it, is anti-Semitic. Where do I have that? Good grief. Oh, way down here. All right. You know, there's nothing anti-Semitic about that salute. It's just a hand movement. But people have put that interpretation on it. I don't even know if it was meant to be that when it got started. So it's only that if you say that it's anti-Semitic, then you can think that it is. But it does nothing to hurt Jews. It doesn't, you know, I mean, it doesn't do anything. It's just an arm gesture, which tells us that Jews are too sensitive to the idea that they're not much liked. And they want to force people to speak and act only well toward them. They want to force people not to make that salute because it's been expressed as being somehow meaning you don't like Jews, and that's just not that cannot be tolerated by Jews who can't stand it, that people should be allowed to say, I don't like Jews, or say some things truthful about Jews throughout history that they don't want said. That's been gone over so many times in the chapters in the International Jew that we've been reading on Thursday that, I mean, it's just, amazing how they want to control mostly what is said and even thought about Jews, about themselves. They want to control what people are allowed to say and think about themselves. So, going on here with Brendan, he says, he says the main justification for the ban is that it would pose a threat to public order. He says that the French Interior Minister, Manuel Valls, or Vallis, I've seen it spelled, says he's censoring Dieudonné because he spreads racism, anti-Semitism, and Holocaust denial. And they have laws against that and so on in France. And so now the French state says it is now going to try to ban videos of Dieudonné's performances from the internet. Now Brendan says banning Holocaust denial is always a mistake. It does nothing to confront or challenge the prejudices that underpin this worldview. On the contrary, it can make them push them underground, make them fester, and even gain in popularity among the more fringe and freakish sections of society. Brendan starts now trying to make out that any kind of Holocaust denial or revisionism is abnormal and weird. See, and so he says censoring it turns it into a kind of forbidden fruit, making it seem dangerous and edgy. Something that so freaks out the entire state, political class, and mainstream of society that it must be stringently criminalized. This gives it a feeling of intrigue. it does nothing to reduce the attraction to those people who are attracted to it. Those people he describes as self-styled outcasts, anti-establishment types. And he goes on like that, you know. And then he says, the terrible irony in Europe today is that the banning of Holocaust denial could be the one thing that keeps this clapped out, fact-free ideology chugging along. So I just say, keep believing this, Brendan. Keep going. He says Then he says, these are numerous reasons why Holocaust denial has gained this new lease of life, but it seems unquestionable that its unwittingly mystification by states and experts keen to extinguish it has been a key contributor to its cultish revival. And I say, go, Brendan, because, you know, he's totally wrong here. He's wrong in this whole, everything he says is wrong in this whole blog, but he's saying that, it's making Holocaust denial either illegal or unacceptable is what is behind its success and why it's had this revival in recent times is what he's trying to say. But that's not the reason, because if we all Holocaust deniers and revisionists, I think, would love it if this would stop being illegal or unacceptable and we could actually put our ideas out there for people to see. But Brendan thinks that if we did put these ideas out there, people would see how bankrupt they were and how bad they were. And he says, the worst tool one could possibly use to combat backward ideas rather than defeating them through the public moral reckoning and the marshaling of truth for a showdown with BS. He's the one that uses the term BS. So he's saying, I didn't get that read quite right, but you know, he's saying that that the worst thing you can do is to try to blank it out, because if we would put our ideas out there in the public and the public could look at them, they would see that they are a bunch of BS. Well, of course, we know that that's not what they would see. And we know that the Holocaust historian and the Holocaust, the media and everything knows that that's not what they would see. That's why they censor it and make it illegal, because they know that it's very convincing. But poor Brendan is of the opinion that if people got to see what the revisionists were writing, that they would see how weak and pathetic it was. Now, I have to say that Brendan has probably never read any of it. He's never read any of it. He's never looked at any of it. He thinks it's too stupid for him to look at, so he doesn't know. And now he goes on with this. He says, Holocaust denial, censorship of Holocaust denial gives the impression that the mainstream of society is defensive on the question of the Holocaust. So defensive that we feel the need to erect around this historical event a force field of censorship, preventing people from questioning what happened. That's exactly what they do. That's exactly right. But he says this hands a moral victory to the deniers, fueling their belief that we, the reasoned people, are trying to hide something. They're the reasoned people. They're trying to hide something. They're scared of debate, worried that the truth of the Holocaust might be easily pricked by, well, pricks. That's what he says. There is no need for such defensiveness, he says. You see, he's totally opposite of what actually is going on there. And if he was in charge, it would be great, because he would say, well, let's see what you've got here and put it all out here and we're all going to look at it. That would be just great. He says, but instead he says, we know. He's including him with the Holocaust truth, the Holocaust believers. We know, we have proven the truth of what happened to the Jews of Europe 70 years ago. He thinks so. He thinks so. He says, sooner or later, robbed of the power unwittingly ascribed to revisionism by the panic and censorship of officialdom, Holocaust denial will go the way of most other lies in history to the grave. Well, it would be great if we had the chance, wouldn't it? It would be great if we had the chance to test that out. I don't know any revisionists who wouldn't be quite up for it and ready. But of course, Brendan is deluded here. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Too bad he's not able to, would not have more influence on the way things happen. All right, so this is just, you know, why, a little bit more for me about why Holocaust is still a viable and very important subject, and why it's still one of the most important subjects that we have to deal with, and why it must continue working with it. And we are making progress. There is a lot of progress. In fact, some of this will be seen as I move along here. So I looked again last night for news about the 69th commemoration of the liberation of the Auschwitz, that for the January 27th, you know, big special day that is commemorated every year since 2006. I did finally go to the Auschwitz-Birkenau website, and they do have a page on it there, and it was put up the 12th of December, as a matter of fact. And it doesn't say much, though, but I'm going to read it just for, it's not that long, and just so that it covers some facts and so on. And they call it the 69th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And they say, on Monday, 27 January 2014, a ceremony will be held for the 69th anniversary of the liberation of the German Nazi concentration and extermination camp Auschwitz. Notice how they have to put all that in there. Honorary patronage over the event will be assumed by the President of the Republic of Poland, Bronislaw Komorowski. Up to the moment of the liberation of the camp area by the Red Army, the Nazis murdered approximately 1.1 million people in Auschwitz, mostly Jews, but also Poles, Roma, Soviet prisoners of war, and people of other nationalities. Today, the world sees Auschwitz as a symbol of the Shoah and atrocities of World War II. In 2005, the United Nations proclaimed January 27th, the International Day of Commemoration in memory of the victims of the Holocaust. That's the name of the day. The ceremony will be of particular significance because of the many anniversaries falling in 2014. Next year marks 70 years since the beginning of deportations to the camp of Jews from Hungary, period. In just 3 months between, now this is what they say, this is the official story, in just 3 months between 15 May and 9 July 1944, the Nazi Germans transported approximately 438,000 Jewish men, women, and children to Auschwitz from Hungary. The majority of them were murdered in the gas chambers immediately upon arrival. This was the largest extermination operation in the history of the Auschwitz camp. Well, because they say that, that is supposed to be fact. And somebody like Brendan thinks that means they have tons of proof that show that that happened. Whereas the revisionists are quite united in their belief, and every revisionist has his own way, his own right to look at things in his own way, you know, but they're united in the belief that there were no gas chambers, and therefore nobody could have been gassed there. But it continues to be said, and this is one of the easiest things to show, but still it's not easy to get it through to people. So going on with the press release they have here, they say the process of deportation of Jews from Hungary was documented by the perpetrators in over 200 black and white photographs, now constituting one of the most important pieces of evidence of the crime. Of course, these photographs that we have, that we see that the Germans took, of the Hungarian Jews arriving in Auschwitz and all kinds of pictures of them, they don't show any evidence of a crime. They don't show any evidence of any crime. But we're supposed to read that into them. You know, when they show you a picture of some peasant-looking type Jews walking down the road in Birkenau with their children, or sitting around in the grass with their children and eating snacks and so on. And then the caption says, Jews on the way to Hungarian Jews on the way to the gas chamber, or the ones sitting there waiting to go to the gas chamber. That's the caption. You know, and that is supposed to be, and it's just amazing that when people see that and they take it as from an authoritative source, they believe it and they think they've seen evidence of something when they haven't. Anyway, it goes on to say, in the photo that accompanies the invitation to the ceremony, and they have it there on their page, real small, but one can see the faces of three children murdered at that time, Dory, Judith, and Wolstein. From the city of Szombathely, you know, they know where they're from, and they know that they were murdered. Now, I have to say there, what a lie. What a lie. They did not murder children. The Germans, or the Nazi Germans, or the SS did not murder children, and these children must have been murdered in a gas chamber. They didn't have gas chambers. They didn't put children in gas chambers. But they're repeating this stuff anyway that they don't know. Then it goes on, in addition, next year, we'll also see ceremonies for the... Now, this is important because the 70th... they're talking about... Okay, well, I'll just read. In addition, next year, we'll also see ceremonies for the 70th anniversary of the liquidation of the so-called Zigeunerlager, that's the gypsy camp, in Birkenau, during which the remaining living Roma and Sinti prisoners were killed. Huh. Not true either. The 70th anniversary of the deportation also, now another 70th anniversary, in they're talking about this year of 2014, of the deportation to Auschwitz of nearly 13,000 Poles arrested during the Warsaw Uprising. Not the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, the Warsaw Uprising. And also the 70th anniversary of the liquidation of the ghetto in Lodz, which was just one of those Polish ghettos. And as well as the 70th anniversary of the revolt of prisoners from the Sonderkommando in Auschwitz. All right, so all these anniversaries this year, because of the just, you know, that's when it all happened in 1944. This is all from 1944, so this year is the 70th anniversary. But what happened in 1945, 2015 will be the 70th anniversary. And it says, they say, the anniversary ceremony on 27 January 2014 will be attended by former prisoners of Auschwitz, representatives of Polish state authorities, as well as many guests from around the world, including a large delegation of the Israeli parliament headed by its speaker, Yuli Yoel Edelstein. The visit of the representatives of the Knesset in Poland was initiated by a foundation from the depths, a foundation that's titled From the Depths, and its director, Johnny Daniels. So they're probably sponsoring that and helping to pay for it, organizing it. Due to the limited, now no mention of Elie Wiesel here. Due to the limited number of seats, those wishing to participate in the ceremony, please contact the organizers before 10th of January. Well, that's already passed. And they say that the celebrations will begin at 1:30 at the site of the former, that's 1:30 p.m. at the site of the former camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau. No, Auschwitz to Birkenau. That means at Birkenau. And the main ceremony commemorating the victims will take place at the monument in Birkenau. That's where those plaques are, and at the end of where the destroyed crematoriums are, between 4 and 4:30 p.m. And in all of this, no mention of Elie Wiesel. So I'm wondering if I haven't seen any stories about him attending, and usually that's what you'd see if you saw stories about this thing. So he may have decided not to come to this one, and they may be downplaying this commemoration this year, because next year, in 2015, with the 70th anniversary, is going to be the big one. And I'm going to be talking about some things that they have planned for that coming up right now. And so it's very possible that they're just going to save all the big guns for next year. And this one will be a little bit quiet, which is okay, because we also have time to get ready for next year. And it's good that I think I'm really pleased that I've gone ahead and worked so hard on this thing. I'm not trying to get a lot of credit, because the credit really goes to the people who put out all this information over the years. But I'm glad we've got this website started. It's you know, it's not a big deal. It's just a website. But at the same time, it's a base for doing more and being ready for a much bigger commemoration of our own next year, when they go all out for the 70th anniversary. And I think that, among other things, we should make a film of our own. Not me, I don't make films, but make a film of our own that's not just the general Holocaust film, that is specifically about Auschwitz and, you know, and what this commemoration stands for, and how it's based on so many lies. It's just based on lies. That's what it is. And point it out in a way that people can't miss getting the message. So I want to go now to this Hitchcock film. Let me get to the top here. And there's so much to say about it that I don't know exactly where to start, except that this one article in The Independent is titled "Alfred Hitchcock's Unseen Holocaust Documentary to be Screened." Well, the first thing is that this is actually footage taken by the British, and in other cases by the Americans, on their entry into the camp. And and then it was supposed to have been put together into a film in 1945. It says, in 1945, Hitchcock had been enlisted by his friend and patron, Sidney Berenstein. Notice that, Sidney Berenstein. Hitchcock was also a Jew. I believe he's dead now, so I have to talk about him in the past tense. He was a Jew, although people weren't aware of that. I never was. Even up until just recently, I learned that. And Sidney Berenstein were enlisted to help with the documentary on German wartime atrocities based on the footage of the camps shot by British and Soviet units. Well, at that time, it was the Bergen-Belsen footage shot by the British. But then they have included in this film other places, Dachau, Buchenwald, Ohrdruf too, and others, and that was all shot by the Americans. They were, you know. And then the only thing the Soviets filmed was at Auschwitz, and they that part of the film was missing. That was the sixth reel, the last reel, and it has never been found. I guess maybe they gave that back to them when they decided not to show the film. I don't know. You know, I'm only speculating here. But anyway, that's the only part they would have played. But they have included that six reel now using some program notes or something that they found. And they have looked up all the film from all the things that were said in the program notes. I guess they have a narrative, and probably was from the narrative, and they've found, you know, pictures and so on. And so they've now replaced that last part of the film. So now it's intact, although not the way it originally was exactly. There's a lot of things to say about this, and I'm going to move down here. Oh, boy. just tell you that the restored version of this film, it's a concentration camp film. It's a liberation of the camps film. Was retrospectively, that is, it. They titled it, all right, let me go back up again. They wanted, I'm looking for where it says, the reason they wanted this film made. Well, they wanted it made, I'll just tell you, because once they moved into those camps and they saw a lot of dead bodies, they saw a lot of very emaciated people who they could say had been starved on purpose by the Germans. They saw a lot of terrible things as well as seeing a lot of healthy, you know, people with smiling faces, you know, cheering and jumping around and looking just fine. A lot of those people too. So how do you explain all that? But anyway, they wanted to make, they made sure that they had film crews there filming all of this. And then they said afterwards, trying to find the name of that person. head of the, brother. I don't know. I don't want to say it and then come upon it later, but I can't find it. But the head of the United States this was the Sidney Bernstein. This makes me mad that I thought I had this somewhere where I'd see it, but I'm not seeing it. Here it is. Here it is. Okay, they've got this person talking, Tony Haggith. And Tony Haggith is someone who is, he's senior curator at the Department of Research in the Imperial War Museum. Well, this film was found, I think, in the Imperial War Museum in an old tin, old film can. And, you know, it's not in very good shape. And it has been shown, at a Berlin Film Festival in the 1980s. Here it is, Berlin Film Festival in 1984. And then broadcast on American PBS in 1985 under the title Memory of the Camps. So I looked for it, and I actually found it quite easily on the PBS. No, I didn't find it on PBS. They don't show the whole film anymore. But I did find it at, I have it here, topdocumentaryfilms.com, Memory of the Camps. You just Google or put in the URL, put in HTTP, topdocumentaryfilms.com/ /memory-of-the-camps/. And that's where I found it. And I watched it. I guess it was just last night I watched it. Or was it two nights ago? I think it was just last night. And I took notes. So I have some information from my notes that I want to go through that I consider all the things that are not truthful, that are false, that they've said. And so after they had all that film made, let me get back to this Tony Haggith. Here he is. He's the well. It was just stored in the Imperial War Museum because they decided not to show the film. It was that they when they went into the camps, they were keen to make a film to show to the German people to get them to accept their responsibility for the atrocities that were there. You see, because now here's how I understand this: when the Allies had reached already in taking over Germany, as they were doing so, they were filming everything. And when they found those camps and they saw the conditions that were there, they thought they had really found a gold mine, and they filmed all that stuff. And then I can't find the name of this. I'm going to come upon it, but the American, I know it was not necessarily maybe American, but it was Sidney Bernstein. Was the head of, I think he's the one, his name was Sidney, was the head of the war crimes, in charge of, doing, propaganda. And so they got him, and, he got, he got Alfred Hitchcock to agree to turn this into a film. And they wanted to show this, but the fact is it doesn't seem like Alfred Hitchcock played a very big role in it. That he looked at the footage and they said it made him so sick that he didn't show up for another week. And it doesn't look like Alfred Hitchcock, although finally he says he may have had some directorial influence over it. But it's not, you can't call it a Hitchcock film, because it's really just footage and a narration going along with it. It's not really a film in the sense that you, it's pretty primitive, I'll tell you. So this Toby Haggith, who's from the Imperial War Museum, he said that they wanted to show this, to make a film very quickly, and show it to the German people to make them accept their responsibility for the atrocities. And the whole point, you see, anybody can see this if you understand any of this history, is that they wanted to absolve themselves. They had this on their mind the whole time as they were going into Germany. They were like, how are we going to blame everything that happened on the Germans? And of course, when they found this, some of the conditions in those camps, they felt they had their answer. And so they had to, they knew that they were guilty of all kinds of war crimes themselves and against the German people, just in the bombing of all the cities of Germany and all of that. And the Germans were still, up until the very end, they were still, supporting Adolf Hitler. They were still supporting National Socialism. They were still patriotic Germans wanting to defend their homeland, and they had a lot of complaints, obviously, against the Brits and the Americans for all the bombing that they did, and the Russians too, and everybody. So, but now how are they gonna? They didn't want the Germans to be resistant and to turn against them. They wanted a supine or a resigned and populace there who would go along with what they wanted. So they thought they would make this film and show it to them. And that is also why they had to turn the Nuremberg Tribunal into this extra legal or super legal or actually illegal farce. Because otherwise, if the defense was able to make a case, they would make their case against the Allies. And that was not allowed. And they made all these rules that are just totally inimical to anything, any kind of justice. So that's why all this was done, because their intention was to turn the focus away from anything, their own wrongdoing, and make the German crime so horrible and so bad that it wouldn't be difficult to blame everything on the Germans and to justify everything that they themselves had done. So this film, you can see this film, see that in this perspective, the reason that they showed what they did and that they said what they did in the film, but then it said that they didn't, it took until the end of 1945 for the film to be completed. And by that time, they said especially the British had changed their mind about wanting to show this to the Germans, and they were trying to get the Germans. I guess the Germans were doing a pretty good job of going along with them anyway. And they wanted to get the Germans on their side, so they didn't want to alienate them. So they didn't actually show this film in Germany. But later, like I said, in 1984, they showed it at a film festival. They said that the German people didn't even want to look at it. They closed their eyes, and a lot of them walked out of the theater. They wouldn't look at it. So they figure, they like to say, though, that it's because they can't accept the terrible things that they were responsible for. And they also make out that somehow all the Germans were responsible for what happened. And I'm going to go through all that when we come back from the break, ladies and gentlemen. So when we do that, I'll have more on this film and another film that's being made, and also then go into the Sandy Hook thing, which should only take about a less than a half hour. Okay, see you in 5 minutes.
Erinnert an deine Qual. Keiner kommt mehr hierher, niemand vermisst dich mehr. Oh, es tut weh, wenn ich deinen Stein so sehe. Treuer Soldat, mehr als ein namenloses Grab. Ich höre Stimmen, ich höre Gespräch. Du Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten, für kein Geld der Welt. Ich kämpfe für dich. Ungebrochener Held, ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich gedanke zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer da noch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld ihr beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand. Ein Totenwächter von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter. Ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Es ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Ihr habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht. Für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen. Ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Es war der Glaube, der euch Verband. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich darf zu dir sprechen. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein.
Ich höre eine Stimme,
zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und bis an der Zeit übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen. Ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for sticking with me through the break. And I am now, this is Carolyn Yeager, and we're talking about the Holocaust some more, and specifically this film that's being reissued in honor of, it's going to be in honor of the 70th anniversary. That will come up in a minute. I want to say that this original film that was never actually shown in theaters and all over the place that they intended to do, and particularly in Germany to the Germans, has been restored using digital technology, and the extra material for the sixth reel has been put in there, and it's all like a brand new film. They say it looks like it was just filmed, you know, last week. It doesn't have all the old grainy quality to it that was what we see now on that website that I told you about. this was done by the Imperial War Museum in Britain. They are kind of sponsoring this and funding it and so on. I imagine they're giving a lot of funds to it. But another thing that I'm going to say a little more about after I finish this part is that there's another documentary that is very similar to this one called Night Will Fall. That's a new one that's being made by some people, and it's going to be shown along with this original refurbished or redigitalized film called the Hitchcock film. It's going to be shown on British TV in early 2015 to mark the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Europe. So this is part of what they've got scheduled for next year's 70th anniversary commemoration time of the, you know, they call it the liberation of Europe, but it really was January 27th is the liberation of Auschwitz, you see. So they want to get away from that. I know they do, but they've got the date there, so it's kind of it's hard to do. But anyway, they're going to be shown together, these two together, at festivals and in cinemas this year. And then they're going to be shown at that special anniversary thing in at the UN and in Poland, and probably wherever else they can build up this 70th anniversary thing. And they're going to call it the Liberation of Europe. You watch and see, rather than the Liberation of Auschwitz. But there we go. Anyway, we have to try to keep the truth going as best we can and not let them get away with all these shifts and changes and so on. But I'm going to describe that other film in a minute, but I think I had better now go on to my list of my reaction to this film that I watched. And I had gotten Hanning Scott had told me that he had seen it several times on PBS. He knew about it. He had seen it in the past, and he thought it could backfire by issuing this film because it makes claims that were later admitted not to be true. Well, so when I watched it, and I was just so happy that I actually could watch it, and I found it there, and you can watch it too. I'll put that link in the program post. But some of the lies in the film, I've got a whole list of them here. Starts out saying that 11 million people were killed in the camps, 6 million Jews. Well, this is the standard fare that they give us. But they cannot show that 11 million people were killed in the camps. You see how they say that, in the camps? Of course, again, this was in 1945. They said a lot of things that they know better than to say today. But they say that this film has kept the original narration. Oh, I have to say that it's narrated by Trevor Howard, who it's not maybe Trevor Howard's voice, but it's the way he used his voice. He was very snide and insulting to the Germans. This film is a pure propaganda film. It's not anything but that. It's just typical 1945 style propaganda. And he narrates, he's got this Trevor Howard has this very British accent, you know, and a very superior tone of voice, dripping with sarcasm, expressing the utmost dislike, disdain, and even hatred for all Germans, really. Never once is any fault of the British or the Allies altogether or ever voiced in the script, and it's all the bad, barbaric Germans throughout the whole thing. It's less than an hour, I think, or it's about an hour long. It's just total hypocrisy, and I think that viewers today will recognize that immediately. So they say they've got a new narrator, they're not going to use Trevor Howard. People would really react negatively to the way he sounded in saying all those things that he said. but they say they have a new actor. They're not saying who it is. They also have a new title for the film. They're not saying what it is yet. But they're using the same script. But I bet that they will not use this script word for word. I'll bet that there will be changes, because some of the things that I'm going to tell you here, they couldn't say today. So I'm going to be very interested to see how much they keep it the same and how much they might change here and think nobody will notice. So they also say that when the British arrived at Bergen-Belsen, the inmates had not eaten for 6 days. And yet there they were, looking very healthy, fine, cheerful, smiling. Lots of women were there, you know, and men too, waving at the troops coming in. And nobody looked like they could have gone 6 days without eating. Because if you don't eat for 6 days, anybody, you're feeling pretty weak, you know. I mean, but not these people. So I don't believe that story. The narration of the film said, well, they had the SS guards who were there, and they were there to turn the camp over to the British, thinking that it was going to, you know, that they had requested the British to come in there. They said, we're totally, you know, unable to keep anything going here. And we know why, is because of the bombing. But, so there they were, and they had them lined up, and they had British soldiers checking their identification and so on, and looking, you know, and these poor guys were just standing there trying to look, you know, soldierly, but they were not smiling or anything. And yet they say in the film that the SS guards were cheerful and well-fed, unlike the inmates, and unconcerned about the state of the place, that they didn't show any concern whatsoever. But that wasn't true, because we know they were concerned. That's why they asked the British to come and invited them to come and take over the camp. Now, they say all these deaths, the narrator says, all these deaths at Belsen have been caused by systematic starvation and typhus and disease because of the treatment meted out by their SS guards and SS chiefs. Well, of course, there was no systematic starvation, and the typhus and disease was not because of the treatment of the guards and the SS in general. It was, they were trying to prevent these things, but they wanted to, they're trying to make you think that they were treated so badly that they ended up getting typhus and other diseases and so on. Well, then they showed, a part for, they put quite a bit of attention on this. They said that they said the Germans said, or they might have said the Nazis or whatever said they, the water pipes were broken and they had no water for such amount of time. So nobody could, drink water or clean up or anything. And, but they, the Snidely said, well, it took us only, you know, half a day or whatever to hook up, to get water hooked up. Acting like the Germans could have easily done so. But, you know, they had equipment and they had, materials and stuff the Germans didn't have. So I'm sure if the Germans could have done that, they would have. But you know, they act like the Germans could have done it, but they on purpose left it that way, with no running water. And so then we see these healthy looking women taking hot showers. There's no men shown. They're showing the women behind, I don't know, blankets hanging or whatever, and these showers hooked up and all the steam, what have you. And you've got, I'll see all these naked women, or a few of them, they look really nice too. They're nice looking, shapely women. They're not starvation cases at all. And they're taking showers and washing their hair. And Trevor Howard, in a pukey, snide way, says, and these are the people who the Nazis said delighted in being dirty. Well, when did the Nazis say that? I don't, you know, see, this is the kind of stuff they add in a film like this. Now they go to Dachau. And they show what they call the gas chamber, or they say this is supposed to be a shower bath. And they show, they zoom in on the shower heads in the ceiling, got all the little holes in them, you know. And after that, they show a picture of Zyklon, a bunch of empty cans of Zyklon B, implying that the Zyklon came out of the shower heads. And they say, and the narrator says, in the shower room, he says, the camera is looking at the shower room, says, they say, the room was not used as a bathhouse, but as a death chamber. Then they show a pile of corpses, you know, but the shower room and the pile of corpses are unrelated, but they put them together. And that's how they do this. And of course, it's known today that no gas ever came out of shower heads, and also that shower room at Dachau was never used, was not a gas chamber. They still try to tell you that it was set up to be a gas chamber. Insane. But these are things, I wonder if it'll still be there quite the same in the, in the new version of the film. And they say also, they show German citizens coming, being brought to Dachau by the Americans, forced to come, and all the terrible things they had to do there. And they say the German citizens knew about Dachau, but didn't care. But that's not true, because they knew there was a concentration camp there, but they didn't know that. Well, actually, what was there at Dachau when the Americans arrived was simply, again, the result of neglect in the last period of time and too many people there that had just arrived. The same thing at Belsen. The reason there are so many people there and so many sick people is because all these camp inmates from camps in the east had to be moved west, and this was part of the convention, you know, the Geneva Convention and so on. And they had to be moved, and so all these people were being shoved into these other camps in the West. Now, that could, you could say that's the fault of the Germans for setting up such a system as this. And you'd have some, you could make an argument there. But you can't say that they, that, that this is the way these camps always were, because they weren't. So, then they go to Buchenwald and they make the claim that prisoners were tattooed across their belly. I never saw a tattoo across the belly unless it'd be just a few oddball people who maybe did it to themselves. I don't know. And forced to labor on starvation diet, on a starvation diet. Well, they weren't on starvation diets at Buchenwald, but at, again, at the very end, there was no food there. The camp commandant is supposed to have said, I want at least 600 Jewish deaths reported in the camp office every day. Well, I had it written down as 6,000, but then I thought that couldn't have been 6,000. Maybe I got that wrong, so I've changed it to 600. In any case, I don't believe that was ever said. Anyway, and they, the narrator says that, the camera finds especially horrible looking disfigured face amongst the, you know, the liberated inmates. And they put the camera on him and they use that piece of film for the narration to say thugs were appointed as block leaders. And then they have show somebody, I don't know, waving a stick around with something on the end of it. And this is all supposed to, you know, make you tell you that people were being so badly abused. And they say corruption was fostered for it gave another excuse for killing, as though, and then they describe how the inmates stole from one another. And they make out that that was encouraged by the SS to give another excuse for killing. And I guess they can kill those or execute those who were involved in the corruption, which is what they did there at Buchenwald. As well, I won't go in, I have to finish this. So, then they say, then they show that table at Buchenwald that's so famous that they also set up in the court in Nuremberg. I think they did. Where they had all those, tattoos, the tanned items that had looked like had tattoo designs, and that lamp, that lamp that they had on the table, and those two shrunken heads. Well, they have that there outside in Buchenwald, and the German citizens who were brought in from Weimar were, you know, led up there and they were showed them looking at those stuff and they looked very perplexed. They didn't understand what they were seeing. But the narrator is saying tattoos were taken from prisoners who had them, meaning who had them. And they were tanned and made into lampshades. Now they said that in this film. And then they said, and then they showed the shrunken heads up close. And said this pair of shrunken heads belonged to two Polish prisoners who escaped, were recaptured, and supposedly were recaptured. And that's all they said. And you are supposed to put it together that this is what was done to these two Polish prisoners who had escaped and were recaptured. They shrunk their heads and had these tokens of shrunken heads that... you know, the way they've said this, they could mean that somehow these two Polish prisoners owned these shrunken heads, but rather than that they were the shrunken heads, but the whole thing is just, you know, to make you believe certain things. And they knew, they thought they could get away with that then. I don't know if they believed this stuff in 1945, but they said a lot of extreme things at that time. Then they show a little bit of footage from Ebensee, which was a really nice place in the mountains. And I guess they had a kind of a hospital there or a place where people go to recuperate. And they showed some sick inmates from there. They were being led by nurses and they looked very weak and, you know, like they didn't quite know what was going on in their hospital gowns, but they showed them bringing them out of the building. And they called the film, said they were victims of starvation, and this was just another evil concentration camp that was in this beautiful setting in the mountains where the SS was having such a good time while they were overlooking the place. And then they showed some film from Mauthausen and said it was opened in 1938. And here they show more sick people and people that are, you know, totally just skin and bones, and they're walking around and so on. And while they're showing these people, they talk about the gas chamber there, but they don't show it, as I recall. And then they show film from Ohrdruf, which was really bad. That's where Eisenhower went to look, and they took, they have lots of film from there. And amongst, they show at Ohrdruf, there were just dead bodies laying around on the, in the open space of the yard and the grounds. I don't know. They said that the SS had shot them all before they left and just left them laying there. They had clothes on and stuff. I don't get that at all. Why they were there? Why they were just laying around dead like that? And they show there the remains of this burnt cremated bodies on outdoor grills. You know, there was just one, and they've shown that in pictures all the time, where I guess they were trying to cremate some of the dead because there were so many dead there. Another case of typhus, and they, I don't know, they didn't have anything to do with them. That's why they were laying around outside dead, and they showed terrible pictures from there, like all sorts of very, very super thin, naked bodies just laying around along the side of the road and so on. But there's no explanation. And I'm sure there is some kind of explanation for all that. But they've never allowed anybody who knew anything about it to say, I guess. So they make up their own stories about it. But there was a lot of death going on at Ohrdruf, and they didn't have a crematorium. I guess they would take them to Buchenwald. But they couldn't do that, I guess. So anyway, they're trying to burn them out in on this outdoor grill, just dead bodies. But anyway, that's a horrible looking part of it. And then at Gardelegen, that's where that big lie is told that 1,000 I don't know, people fleeing or Jews or whatever were locked in a barn, which was then set on fire, and then SS put them in that barn and then set it on fire. And research has shown that from looking at the remains and the pictures and so on, that this was not the case. It's not what happened. But anyway, that's what they say in the film. And then finally they're at Auschwitz, and they say in the film that 4 million were murdered at Auschwitz. And but this was the lost reel, so there's no pictures, but the film crew, there is some narration, and the film, they come up with some pictures from other places. I recognize some of the film, some of the pictures from Dachau and other places that they repeat at that part. But I guess now they have that replaced with something. So we're going to see what they show Auschwitz to be in the new version. But what are they going to do about that? The narrator saying 4 million were murdered there. I bet they'll change that. And I bet they won't say, well, it changed from 4 million to 1 million. So again, you know, my impression of the film as I was watching it, I was just furious. I was fit to be tied. And I hated this narrator, Trevor Howard, with a passion. And well, I don't feel that way right now, but while I was watching it, I just hated the British with everything in me for what they were portraying there. You have to see it to understand what a job they did there on Germans and Germany. Not just on Nazis, as they call them, but they kept pointing out that the Germans knew about all this and let it happen, and they had no regret, no remorse, no this and no that, and how they need to be made to see the error of their ways and so on. And so I already said a few things about it, about the narrator. Anyway, I think if what they show in this fixed up version remains pretty much the same, I think viewers will recognize immediately that they're looking at total hypocrisy. I really do. There's people who won't, but a lot things have changed since then. People have learned a lot about those what's really behind what they found in the last day, you know, at the end of the battles and when they went into those camps. And it's the film is, you can tell that the film is totally self-serving. It's by the people who made it, and it's not really convincing. It's out of date, you know. It's clear, I think, that the Germans are blamed for too much. Nobody would believe that the Germans were just to blame for all of this, and nobody else has any responsibility for it. And the fact is that, you know, the truth is that what was found in these camps at this time was the fault of the actions of the British and the Americans in these camps in the West. They're the ones who are responsible. They knew what they were doing on the ground. They knew what their bombing was doing. They wanted it to do that. They wanted to destroy as much as possible. They had no concern for, oh, let's just hurt these people and not those people. Everybody, you know, everybody they just bombed like crazy and let everything come out as it would. And then when they come in afterwards, they set it up like they're the saviors. Well, we've come to save you. So we'll just have to wait and see if what the reaction to this will be. And now here I was going to say that this other documentary that's being made, I think it's probably being made to be shown with the one that's with the so-called Hitchcock film, which was called what was it called? Something from the camps. It's not going to be called that now. But they're going to be shown together as they go around making the rounds, you know, in theaters and cinemas and so on. And this Night Will Fall is a feature-length documentary. It's already been made. It was finished in 2013. And here's a synopsis of it. In the spring of 1945, Allied forces liberating Europe found evidence of atrocities which have tortured the world's conscience ever since. As the troops entered the German concentration camps, they made a systematic film record of what they saw. Work began on a documentary to show the horror they witnessed to the German population. Well, here's this part I was looking for. No wonder I didn't find it. It's way down here. Sidney Bernstein, chief of the psychological warfare film section of SHAEF, or S-H-A-E-F, you know, that's the thing that Eisenhower was head of. Can't think real quick how that is, what those word letters stand for, but he commissioned the film. So Sidney Bernstein, a Jew, was naturally head of the psychological warfare film section of the American Allied forces that were in charge of Europe after the end of the war. He commissioned it. Those involved in the production included Alfred Hitchcock and renowned editor Stuart McAllister. They produced perhaps the most remarkable testament of the 20th century. And they say in this film, in the commentary, no German can say he didn't know. This is what they're trying to get across. No German can say he didn't know what was going on because of the so-called Hitchcock film, if you look at that and believe it. So now these sentiments were judged by the British government to be unsuitable to the bridge-building mood towards Germany, so the film was never shown. 40 years later, an American researcher found it. You know, we know that story. We know all this story. And so now, the Spring Films, that's the name of their film company, in association with Angel TV and the Imperial War Museum, is producing a 90-minute documentary for theatrical and television release. This documentary, entitled Night Will Fall, is to coincide with the release of the remastered original film and will tell the remarkable story behind the making of the film, the people involved, and the reasons why it was never shown. So it sounds like they're going to have this 90-minute. They've got a 90, then they've got a quote mark after that. Like it'd be 90 inches or something, but it must stand for 90-minute. They produced this film to go along with the re-released Hitchcock film in order to explain to people, because that film itself is going to bomb, I'm sure. But now they're going to show this one with it, and who knows how they're doing this. It's all a bunch of Jews doing this. They're going to tell the story behind the making of the film, who was involved in it, and why it was never shown. So this is, the director is Andre Singer. That's a Jewish name, Singer. Directorial advisor is Stephen Frears, and the executive producer is Richard Melman. There's another Jewish name. I don't know about Frears. He could be, too. Anyway, there they are. There you've got this. And this is going to be shown on British TV in early January, in early 2015. That would be January. You can bet for the January 27th commemoration, that they're going to call the liberation of Europe, not just but it's the liberation of Auschwitz was January 27th. I mean, see how they lie about everything, because they can't tell the truth. As time goes on, to keep this thing going, they have to keep twisting and turning around and trying to put the emphasis elsewhere, away from the big mistakes that they've made. But we will keep on this. So now, again, I said I'm going to have Guillermo Rudolph and Bradley Smith on the Heretics Hour on Monday, and then I might put the website online for that. So it's a lot to do between now and then. But I'll let you know about that. So now, though, I promised I was going to talk about Sandy Hook, and I'm going to do that. Let me get back to my, okay, here we go. because it has come up again in a kind of debates or something, you know, the fussing over debates. Let me get to the beginning here. Where is it? Here it is. Between Jim Fetzer and Michael Collins Piper, and on the John Friend radio program. And then I wrote, I couldn't keep myself from writing a short short little blog post about it at my website, CarolynJaeger.net. And I've been thinking about it. And then Deanna Spingola did a program, which was kind of unusual for her, which she spent the whole program talking, just herself, about how she perceives the Sandy Hook shootings and why and all of that. And I listened to that. And as I was listening, at some point, I thought some of it was good, but some of it was, I agreed, and I agreed with some of it, not all of it. But at some point, it just occurred to me, it kind of snapped in my own mind, that a possibility that I have mentioned many times and have never, you know, I've always seen as a part of it, that was the main truth about the whole thing, about all of these events, a lot of these events, let's say, not all of them, a lot of these events, and that is that the people that let me, how do I put this? That all the anomalies, all the crazy things that people can't believe, all the things that make people question these events as not being what they say they are, they're all put in there on purpose, by those who, either have created them to begin with or who are reporting on them and trying to take advantage of what's there. It could be either way. It might be a mix, some way, some another way. And that they're put there in order to keep people like us who get involved in these debates and follow this for years and years, to keep us distracted and busy and talking about it. And that, because there's no other explanation for why these events would be so badly handled, right? Because they are. I mean, why do they have so many stupid, unbelievable, and crazy things, say, such as Building 7 going down? Although you can explain that as a mistake that they, or something that they thought they could get away with. But I'm not even going to get into 9/11. I will just say here to start that what they could be working with is that I think it's kind of a truism that if people, for most people, you know, for the average person, which is who they're targeting all the time, if people you trust, and a lot of people trust the newscasters, particularly the ones they watch or listen to regularly, or if the president, a lot of people trust the president, police and firefighters, people trust them when they speak, or sheriffs, and all kinds of, you know, if there are people that you trust, and teachers, people tend to trust teachers too, and doctors, and, you know, laboratory technicians and what have you. If they say that something happened, most people will accept it. They will accept it. They will. They'll say, "Well, it must have happened then," or they'll just in themselves feel satisfied. That's probably one of the psychological profiles that they're testing or that they're using, is to find the limits of what people will believe, because of who is telling them and that they how much trust they have in these sources. So somebody wrote to me yesterday or the day before and brought this subject up and said that that he thought that all the participants might have sold out, including Mike Piper, Jim Fetzer, and John Friend. And I think I wrote back to him, or I didn't, and I'm just going to say it on today's show, I don't think that Mike Piper has sold out. I mean, that's not what Mike Piper is going through. Who would he sell out to, and why would he sell out? What would he get out of it? I just don't think so. But I know that Mike Piper is not in good, health, and he may be on medication. And I have experienced myself, some rather over aggressive emailing from Mike. This was a while back about Mark Weber and what I should be saying about Mark Weber and so on, even before I was recently speaking out about Mark Weber. And it seemed a little bit unusual for Mike Piper. I was really surprised, and I didn't respond all that well, so we ended up with kind of a bad feeling there. But as I hear this from other people, that he's sent emails that, well, it's just not his, you know, the way he ever used to be. So I think that he might be on some medication that's making him not exactly himself, or his bad health might be irritating him and making him impatient and so on. But I don't believe at all that he's sold out. But Jim, and I don't believe that John Friend or Jim Fetzer are sold out, but I do believe that they could very well be working as gatekeepers and be working as people to, not gatekeepers, but people to keep this kind of distraction going. Especially Jim Fetzer, who's been doing this for so many years. and he never gets tired of it. Although, you know, that in itself doesn't say anything. But because he just could be totally focused on it, like I get focused on things. But I'll just say this, my thoughts about this whole thing. That governments can't be so stupid as we see these things, you know, being done by government. And media can't be so stupid as to perform so sloppily and to, you know, not do their job at all and to not question these things. And all of the anomalies that are present in these what I have called shock events, and all of the silliness that you notice in it going. I just can't believe that that these people are, this is the best these people can do. Because as even Jim Fetzer and John Friend, especially John Friend, always proclaims, even a child can see through this. They'll say, well, if anybody would pay attention to this, they'd say, this can't be so. Why don't people see this? So they should see this. And, you know, he's like, we need to see through this stuff. Well, it's not that you can't see through it. The question should be, why is it happening like this? How could these people be so incompetent? I don't believe that they are. You know, if they're not, then they're making it, what they're doing is making it easy for us to see the anomalies that don't add up in these stories, as so that it's only natural that there would be a number of people who would be building up conspiracy theories about it. And it would be the thinking people, the brightest people, the most independent minded of us will go in this direction of trying to figure out, what really happened here, because obviously it's not the way they say it was. That's how I see Sandy Hook. It's that the way they presented this in the news, with saying that something happened and yet giving no pictures except these strange things on TV, giving no information, showing no documents, not showing the evidence, not having any evidence, and being just showing this crazy neighbors and people talking and so on, and then talking to parents and interviewing all these parents of children who were butchered in this, supposedly in the classroom, never showing the pictures inside, even after they took the children out, if they were there. Never letting a film crew or film person come in and photograph what it looked like so that people could see and could accept. No, never doing any of that. Encouraging people, encouraging conspiracy theories about it. How else can you react to something like that besides saying, this is all fake. Why won't they show us anything? I don't think anything happened here. It was done that way. It seems to me it would have to be that it was done that way on purpose in order to create people spending a lot of time thinking about how this thing worked and talking about their theories. And just like we have it. We have some people don't, but there are a lot of people who are very, very interested in this and spend a lot of time talking about it. And they argue with one another or they discuss their findings and they say, it could be, what about that? What about this? And every little detail is checked into. And then it could be helped along. No doubt there's helpers put out there, like someone like Jim Fetzer. Now, I'm not saying he is. I don't know that. He might be one of those who's just gotten into this kind of thing because he's a thinking, bright person and likes to think about things like this. But he could be one of those, because they've got to be there. You know, they got to have the people who are helping to lead the way. And he's been leading the way for quite a long time. Now, whether John Friend is one of those leading the way or he's being led, I don't know. But he ought to be thinking about this, if he's smart enough to do so. Or maybe he just wants an issue, and this is a good issue that he likes, and so he's going to stick with it. But if we're really looking for the truth, we have to say, why then would they be doing this? And I ask myself, is the death of 20 second graders in one school, in one American town, the most important threat to our well-being as a people? You know, when things like this happen, you're like all of us, we get emotionally struck and kind of carried away, and oh my God, so terrible, how horrible, oh, how could anybody do that, oh, how could such a thing happen, and all these innocent little kids, and you know, and that's some people never get past that stage. And yet, looking at it in the big picture, as to the problems, the real problems that we have, that we should be dealing with, is even something like this. 20 kids, 20 little innocent kids, if it happened, being killed, the worst thing and the most important thing that's going on in the United States and to us, or is any school shooting or fast food restaurant shooting or post office shooting the greatest threat we face? You know, I think the honest answer has to be no. I mean, honestly, for me, it is no. The greatest threat we face is the changing demographics of our country. This is the only country we have, you know, and it is a country where, our greatest threat then is immigration, legal and illegal, and the changing demographics of our country and the lessening of any influence that we as white Americans have. Even if it's not about being white, even if you're not caring about the white race, this country is still being destroyed by immigration and by multiculturalism. And it is the only country. But for us white people, that's even worse, see, because we can't go somewhere else. We can't go to Africa or back to Pakistan or back to, you know, Timbuktu or whatever, where and be happy and have a life there like these other people can. This is it. And the only other place we have is Europe. And we know Canada is being taken over totally by the Jewish powers. And this country is taken over by Jewish powers, too. And that's why this is happening. But just to get back to the whole loss of our country. And the other way we're being robbed of our wealth, not only of our nation, our country, but we're being robbed by the policies and impoverished by the policies of the Federal Reserve, and actually the policies of our own government, which support the Federal Reserve and the major banks and corporate America, all that are cooperating. I'm not saying that I don't think corporate America is in cahoots with the Federal Reserve. I don't. But corporate America has its own interests and is not going to do anything to help us. And the Federal Reserve is just an arm and one aspect of the whole financial banking, world banking system. But we are being robbed of our national assets. And as citizens of this country, we're all in terrible debt. We're in greater and greater debt. We have nothing. We're being robbed of everything. And I think that a lot of this stuff is done to distract us from these realities. This is what they don't want thinking, intelligent, creative, and independent-minded people to be dealing with and to get together about. So a lot of these things could very well be done to take us away from dealing with what we should be dealing with. And I think it works. You know, I think this because I think that the way we are made as human beings, they have found that this is a good way to do it. It works well. And what they most want to be able to continue with their robbing of the white people of the world and the destruction of the white people of the world before we wake up and do anything about it. So I'm saying then that these events may be created with the screw ups and the unbelievable aspects that are a part of them in order to spawn the kind of disbelief and doubt that we see now look how long it took the JFK conspiracy activity. That has lasted since 1963 is still going on. Somebody wrote to me about the moon landing today and saying that cameras have seen the flags on the moon. They're still there, the flags that were planted by the astronauts. Now, I was reading all about that moon landing conspiracy, and because they show a lot of pictures, they show a lot of things that you said, you know, and if you're not looking at both sides simultaneously, you don't have time to study it enough, you can easily believe one side or the other without really having enough background to know. But I was entertaining that. I thought, well, look at this and look at that. My gosh, you know. And it made sense that we couldn't really go to the moon. Well, how come we've never done it since and gone anywhere else, you know, in a manned flight? So it all made sense. But later on, I decided I didn't know and I wasn't going to focus any energy on it. And so I was going to have to remain just, you know, undecided about it. But this person said that, that I don't know if he's right or not, just sent me an email that, some of the cameras that they have, whatever, got some pictures and the flags that were placed there could be seen still there. So this is now from, this is after the JFK assassination that this moon flight went during Lyndon Johnson's, tenure, but yeah, that's back then too, and that's still going on. And then we have, of course, 9/11 is now going on 13 years. People have devoted tons of time and energy, and it seems to be the most important thing in the world to them. I, of course, spend a lot of time and think is the most important thing is Holocaust, and I'm going to continue. I'm not going to stop because I don't see people mentioning 9/11 or JFK or the moon landing or anything like that for a reason why we have to support Israel and why we have to stamp out anti-Semitism and so on. But so to me, the Holocaust is in a different class all by itself. And everything that I was saying about that Hitchcock film, everything about World War II and so on is the same thing. It's different. It's real history. I will continue with that. But anyway, all of these events have these loose threads hanging from them that no one can seem to prove it right or wrong, or I think some of it has been proved, but it's not accepted by the officialdom, and so it's like it wasn't proved, and so therefore, but it keeps people's minds occupied. It keeps them thinking that the enemy is somewhere, you know, there in those kinds of events, and it's the government, it's the Mossad, it's the Jews, it's this, it's that. But you know, if we could solve this, if we could just solve this particular thing, whether it's JFK, 9/11, Sandy Hook, and I mean prove it to the rest of the world, get it all cleaned up and nice and neat without these threads hanging, well, we would change the world. These people would be put in jail or whatever, people who are doing it. Well, you see, that's probably the fantasy. That's probably the fantasy and the fallacy, the delusion that this can be done and that we're going to put these people in jail and we're going to string these people up. I don't know. These kind of things are not going to do it. The people, the people who are behind all this stuff to distract us are the ones who want to keep the advance of the brave new world of global consumerism going. And this is kind of a broad field, you know. Global consumerism, New World Order, and so on. It's hard to know how to attack that, so you can attack it through these various little events. But people get all caught up in that, and that seems to be the most important thing to talk about. So I see no other explanation, anyway, for the major incompetence in the handling of every one of these events. It's not like ordinary incompetence, like with Obamacare. Obamacare is not one of these things. Obamacare is just an incompetent mess because of, you know, the person who's it's named after. But give away signs, that what you're seeing is not natural. It doesn't follow the laws of nature, you know, or physics or common sense. Those might be giveaway signs that's one of these things. Because who would dream something up like that went against physical laws and went against common sense so much? These are like big flags that are waving to tell us. They're put there on purpose to draw our attention, say, hey, you know, you alienated and angry people out there, look at this. Look at this. Look what the government's trying to do to you. Look what the media is trying to put over on you. And then get them to focus on that. And if enough people focus on these things for enough time, they can take away a lot of what would be otherwise maybe a more unified approach from the people to make some improvement in the situation we've got here. And the improvement has to be against the taking away from us of our country and of all our money. You know, without any resources and without any control over the government of this country, we're just gone. There's nothing left. That's not giving any answers. That's not giving anything, any much hope even there. So I don't have the answers to these things, but I wouldn't spend my time on this stuff anymore after I've seen this, you know, after this has come together, more completely in my mind. I wouldn't spend any time on these, conspiracy theories, but I would spend time on Holocaust and World War II, history, getting that straight. And also, of course, I think the reason is we don't know what to do about the immigration problem. We don't have any power already to do anything about it. And we can't unite either, because that seems to be impossible. I will say that I've got a minute, I think. There was a story today about Adam Lanza, the so-called gunman at Sandy Hook, and that he called a radio station a year ago to discuss the 2009 mauling of a Connecticut woman by a chimpanzee. And the person who came out with the story is somebody named, Matt Lysiak, or Matt Lysiak. That's an Eastern European name of some kind. And I saw a picture of him. He looks Jewish for sure. He really does. And he says he's sure the voice is Adam Lanza's. But what would he be going on? He is the one who found this classmate, says the former classmate, Kyle Kromberg, told the Daily News that he recognized the voice as Lanza's. But then it came out that Kromberg was not a friend of Lanza's, but was only in one class with him. So all of this is, you know, makes a big splash in the papers, but it's not as strong as the way it sounds, although it could have been him. I still think the focus is on Adam Lanza when it comes to Sandy Hook. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening today, and do tune in on Monday night for a very good Heritage Hour show. Goodbye for now.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.